I have brought a Bible.
A very important book in my life.
And I have brought another book
that I'm going to read from in a little bit. It's a really old one. All right. How many recognize this book? I've seen it before. Not this exactly, but this. 101 Famous Poems. Okay. Oh, good. I'm going to introduce it to you. And I've got some other stuff to introduce. But my talk tonight, you know, I thought about, you know, what do I like to talk about? I like to talk about body acceptance. I like to talk about body acceptance because I think it's a problem in our culture that we don't accept our bodies. And so the Lord's challenged me with leg bag for incontinence and flu problems going on this week. But that wasn't the subject the Lord brought to me. He brought to me something that I think will encourage people when they go into creatives, and that is why I write poetry. Why I write poetry. I want to read something to you before I begin, though. It's Psalm 45. It's 1 through 11. And it's from the... I've looked at different translations. I really like this one because I think it fits for tonight's talk. It's from the New Living Translation. The Living Bible was a very much of a paraphrase, but when they made the New Living Bible, they took it back a little bit to more translation, which I really appreciate. So the New Living Bible is a very nice version if you'd like to get a hold of one and read one. Beautiful words stir my heart. I will recite a lovely poem about the king, for my tongue is like the pen of a skillful poet. You are the most handsome of all. Gracious words stream from your lips. God himself has blessed you forever. Put on your sword, O mighty warrior. You are so glorious, so majestic. In your majesty, ride out to victory, defending truth, humility, and justice. Go forth to perform awesome and awe-inspiring deeds. Your arrows are sharp, piercing your enemies' hearts. The nations fall beneath your feet. Your throne, O God, endures forever and ever. You rule with a scepter of justice. You love justice and hate evil. Therefore, God, your God, has anointed you, pouring out the oil of joy on you more than anyone else. Myrrh, aloes, and cassia perfume your robes. In ivory palaces, the music of strings entertains you. King's daughters are among your noble women. At your side stands the queen, wearing jewelry of finest gold from Ophir. Listen to me, O royal daughter. Take to heart what I say. Forget your people and your family far away. For your royal husband delights in your beauty. Honor him, for he is your lord. Isn't that a beautiful poem? That's a beautiful poem. You know, the Psalms. The Psalms are full of poetry. Last night, it was very confirmational that Carol shared to me. It's confirmational to me that Carol shared from Ecclesiastes. And she shared a part of Ecclesiastes. It's one of the most exalted parts of it as poetry, because it used metaphor. And it used in such a beautiful way to describe aging, that some of you don't want to think about, but it's there. It's right there in Scripture. Have you ever read Edgar Allan Poe, The Haunted Palace? Anybody read that? You know what? I think he borrowed that from Ecclesiastes, because he used so many of the same kinds of illustrations and metaphors. But the Bible, why is Scripture so full of poetry? Adam was the first poet. Did you know that? Adam was the first poet. Here's what he said. This at last is bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman because she was taken from man. You know, it's really cool. There's even rhyming in what he wrote there. And the Psalms, of course, you know, are all full of poems. Prophecies. People don't know. If you just study prophecy and you look at the Old Testament prophets, you'll find that it's filled with poetry. In fact, we don't get it as much because we don't read the Hebrew. But if you read the Hebrew, like the book of Habakkuk, that's some of the most highly exalted poetry in the Hebrew language is the book of Habakkuk. And it's filled with metaphor. It's filled with beautiful language, poetry. And before I discovered that what I wanted to do in life, you know, think, what am I going to do when I grow up and that kind of thing, I was already a poet. And the short explanation of why I write poetry is this. It's summed up in that first verse of that psalm, Psalm 45:1. I'll read from King James here, the New King James. My heart is overflowing with a good theme. I recite my composition concerning the king. My tongue is the pen of a ready writer. In other words, my heart overflowed with a good thing, and I began to write. And it all began on my father's lap. My dad would read me two books. He would read this book to me. I think it was actually sometimes he would get out that old big family Bible that covered our legs. You know, it was so big. And he would read to me out of that Bible. And then he read this book. That was the other book. And this is the exact copy of the one he read to me when I was just a little tiny kid on his lap. He taught me something. He said, David, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. So son, pray to get the fear of the Lord so that you'll grow up to be a smart man. And you won't have to work so hard like me. He was an outdoor construction. He worked electrical, roughing in houses. It was really hard work. Sometimes sometimes he would come home and he would say, "Kids, drag me in. I'm tired. You have to help drag me in. I can't quite make it in." He was joking, and he also used to say, "I'm old, way before my time. And he was actually the one that lasted most, Murray and I, our parents. He's the one that died last. But anyway, he taught me the fear of the Lord by reading me scriptures and taught me and told me to pray for it. He said, pray for the fear of the Lord. And I did. I did pray for the fear of the Lord. And it's a big thing, big factor in my life. But I caught something from him also. He taught me something, but I caught something from him, and that was his love of good poetry, good poems. Now, I never got to hear all of the poems in this book. I never got to hear them because my dad, he'd always go back to his favorites, and he would read them over to me, and he read them so often that he actually memorized some of them by heart. I think he could almost say The Raven by Edgar Allan Poe. He could almost say that whole thing through. And he said so, he read it so many times to me. He read this poem to me. And I'm going to read it to you. He made me real proud of him one day at church, a Father's Day church party, when he stood up and he quoted this by heart from Rudyard Kipling. If you don't get anything else out of this, this is a great message for boys growing up to be men. If you can keep your head when all about you are losing theirs and blaming it on you. If you can trust yourself when all men doubt you, but make allowance for their doubting too. If you can wait and not be tired by waiting. Or being lied about, don't deal in lies. Or being hated, don't give way to hating. Yet don't look too good nor talk too wise. If you can dream and not make dreams your master, if you can think and not make thoughts your aim, if you can meet with triumph and disaster and treat those two impostors just the same, if you can bear to hear the truth you've spoken, twisted by knaves to make a trap for fools, or watch the things you gave your life to broken and stoop and build them up with worn-out tools. If you can make one heap of all your winnings and risk it on one turn of pitch and toss and lose and start again at your beginnings and never breathe a word about your loss. If you can force your heart and nerve and sinew to serve your turn long after they are gone and so hold on when there is nothing in you except the will, which says to them, hold on. If you can talk with crowds and keep your virtue, or walk with kings, nor lose the common touch, if neither foes nor loving friends can hurt you, if all men count with you, but none too much, if you can fill the unforgiving minute with 60 seconds worth of distance run, yours is the earth and everything that's in it. And what is more, you'll be a man, my son. That's an awesome poem, isn't it? I grew up on that. That is what I grew up on. I grew up on stuff. There's more in there like that. And he read those to me, and many he memorized by heart. Rudyard Kipling has written a lot of poems that are similar to that. There's one at the end. I don't think I'll have time to read it. The high esteem that poetry had in me, and coupled with the fear of the Lord, which is the beginning of wisdom, it produced what this verse is talking about. Because the fear of the Lord is important as an underlying thing in your life. But the expression of the fear of the Lord, that's important too. And this high esteem for poetry, which is what the Bible is, a lot of the Bible is written in poetry. It produced in me what verse 45, or verse 1 of chapter 45 of Psalms talks about. My heart overflowed. My tongue became the pen of a ready writer. Now, my oldest surviving poem that I have is from age 13. And you say, well, did you start early? Yeah, I did start earlier writing poetry. But age 13, I have a poem that survived. And I'll explain a little bit about it. There are two elements, as far as I know. Okay, I never took a course in poetry. I only studied it by reading good poems. But there are two elements that I know, from having written a lot of poetry, that make a good poem. And that is inspiration and skill. Inspiration and skill. Now, inspiration isn't just a feeling about an idea. I got an inspiration. It's almost like it's an openness to the feeling to let it grow inside of you until it overflows. That's what inspiration is, or inspiration that will produce poetry. And then skill. Skill isn't just like training for a sports event, you know, or maybe making sketches that you're trying to make sketches because you're thinking about doing a painting. But you're just making sketches. What it really is practicing. It's like you're practicing to weave words into a message that is ear-pleasing. Now that poem is ear-pleasing to me. Of course, I've heard it a lot of times. It might have been something you say, I'd like to come back to that. And that's another thing in poetry. It's a part of a skill. Have you ever had a movie that you want to watch over again? Or a book that you'd like to read again? A story that you'd like to come back to? Or this popular song that was played? The one that comes to my mind is Cats in the Cradle. I mean, it has a story with pathos in it. It has a story. It builds to a climax and it has a conclusion and your heart works through it and you want to get to that conclusion again. So you'll go through the poem, or you'll go through the story, you'll go through the song, you'll go through the movie, because you want to get to that end point. That is called, in art, or in design, it's called repeat closure. And people who know how to do that, they make mucho bucks in advertisement. Because if you can find a commercial that people want to see over again, and over again, and over again, or even want to see the picture that takes your mind through something, and you end up this place, those people make money. It repeat closure. But there's no money in poetry as far as I know. So my earliest poems were like that, training for a sports event, or just writing sketches that maybe for painting later, you know. And then as my skills in writing grew, and learning the tools, and picking, and I didn't really learn tools from anybody except these people. From these poets, I just learned by what they were writing. Edgar Allan Poe is probably the one that taught me the most about rhyming, anyway, and the flow and the meter and all those kinds of things. that made the poem something you want to come back to and read again, even though I don't like the message and the Raven is terrible, awful thing, and Haunted Palace is even worse. But something was expressed. That man, if you understand Poe's life, he was expressing feeling. You know, he was expressing something. But like I said, this idea of encapsulating a message inside of poetry, inside of this word crafting that you've made, that's what the Bible has. That's why you go to Ecclesiastes and you read that last chapter, remember your Creator in the days of your youth, before the evil day closed. And then it launches out into this thing that's just a metaphor of all of what our bodies go through as we age. But I do want to read that poem to you. Oh, here it is. I do want to read that poem at 13, because this is when I saw that there was a way I could put a message into the poem. And this is 13 years old, probably, of course, written before Christmas. A Christmas thought. When Christmas comes with Christmas trees and Christmas gifts and fine candies, I wonder what the Savior sighs as he stares down from heaven's skies. Not many people dare neglect to pay this day its due respect by the exchange of gifts in turn, but of the meaning, what concern? A time for fun, a time for play, a jolly time is Christmas Day. Look at the gifts beneath the tree, a gift for me, a gift for me. What happened years and years ago that we do honor this day so? I think it's kept to give applause to some old man named Santa Claus. No school next week, it's Christmas time, so class, let's sing the Christmas rhyme. Oh, hurry, hurry, Christmas Day, please hurry, Santa, on your way. Bring with you candy canes and toys for all the little girls and boys. Oh, this wicked season's chills, and Christmas cards and Christmas bills. The party's still, young pal, don't leave. Have one more beer, it's Christmas Eve. Yes, the memory of the sun. I'm going to have a hard time going through this. Yes, the memory of the Son, who is the Christmas Holy One, seems to have found a minor place behind the mask of a Christmas face. Tell us, Grandma, we want to know. At Christmas time, why does it snow? Someone up in heaven, my dears, cries many sad and happy tears, and as they fall, the cold world's air freezes them all without a care. I wrote that when I was 13, and my mom, David's our poet, David's our family poet. How many remember my mom, Lois Hatton? Yeah, remember my mom, I love her. She said, David's our poet, so David, read your poem to me. And you know, I said, read Christmas Thought. So I read it glibly, you know, going back to it. But when I got to that part, I burst into tears, couldn't hardly get through it. And the Lord was just showing, you can't get away from that, David. You've got my message in your heart. But poems don't always preach. Many on my dad's lap out of this book preach, but there are some here don't preach. They're just expressing a feeling. Like the Raven is a very, very much an expression of a deep felt grief, really. So the heart overflows. The heart overflows. Sometimes merely with personal feelings. And after my coworkers, I actually put a little poem book together, one of those mimeograph, fix them together, Xerox them or whatever, and then stapled them together for Christmas poems and gave them out to my staff in the ER when I first started working in this ER. I wanted to get them to know them better, and I wanted to do something for them for Christmas, and I wanted to witness to them, you know. And so I gave that out to them, and later on, my co-workers, knowing that I was a poet, two of them came to me, and they brought me their poems. They brought me their poems to read. They said, see what you think of this, David. Both of them were going through it. One was a lady, a triage nurse. She had just lost her sister. Her twin had just died. So she wrote several poems. And this other fellow was going through a divorce with his wife, and I think they'd only been married like three or four years, and he was going through it. He was Both of these people, they did not have poetic skill. They did not have the skills built up. But you know what was happening in their grieving? Their hearts were overflowing. Their hearts were overflowing, and they had to overflow out of their hearts onto paper. And you know, writing poetry down can be very therapeutic. It's not just a way to cope with going through something. It's not just a way to cope. But it's almost like you are externalizing what's inside your heart. You're sort of like externalizing on paper so that you can take it now, instead of just looking at feeling it subjectively, you can now look at it objectively. And you can not only look at it objectively, you can actually share it, like those people shared their poetry with me. Or you can do something else, and it does something else. You can bury it in a file. And it becomes a your poem becomes a tombstone on that situation. Now, what do? We go back and visit the cemetery, don't we? You can go back into the file and pull that out and read it again and continue the grief process a little more, maybe, and then put it back in the file. And you go to the cemetery to lay flowers on the tomb or what? And so poetry can serve very therapeutic reasons. In fact, I knew it did that, but I didn't know that people were actually hired to go into hospitals and do poetry therapy. That's pretty cool. I don't know if they could do that for full-time work. So before, I was always putting stuff down on poetry in high school, man. High school, when your hormones are rising, you're getting crushes on, all these girls are running around, and you get all that stuff, you start writing poetry, and boy... it's a way of coping. For me, this famous quote from Percy B. Shelley, was a poet. He said, "A poet is a nightingale who sits in darkness and sings to cheer its own solitude with sweet sounds." Wow. In other words, I'm just doing this to cope, you know, because I'm lonely, you know. And so, if you open up a book of poems, you're going to find a bunch of poetry of what's called unrequited love poems. Unrequited love poems. People who wanted to have that relationship with the person they had a crush on. They wrote the poem, but it's just a poem of, you know... I even memorized a poem. Yeah, I'm not going to share it. I memorized a poem like that because I was going through unrequited love. But I'll share one that I did write, and it's a humorous one because it was my way of getting back. And Samuel recently said that he liked this, one of my poems, he liked it the best. "Hey, Cupid, all right, where's that stupid Cupid guy? I'd like to take his little neck and twist it all the way around his bow. He's made a wreck of me, that mischief-making runt. 3 times I heard that silly twang, and each time only me he hit. If I had my way, I would hang him. He would hang so high for all he's done to me. I'd stuff his arrows down his throat and tie him up and gag his mouth. And in a leaking, sinking boat, I'd shove the rascal out to sea. But I'd be gentle with the brat, if only when he shot his bow, his arrows wouldn't be aimed at just me alone, but that he'd start to shoot into another part, the one he made me set apart. I'm glad I sank him in the river and drowned him, so I didn't want him to do that." Yeah. So poems can let off emotional steam. How many have written poems because they wanted to write off emotional steam? Right. That's built into you by your Creator. You don't even have to study it. It's built into you by your Creator. There's a whole bunch of things that are built in that we don't even think about. We learn about them in school, but we don't even think about them. They're built into us by our Creator. So they can let off emotional steam, but they can also preach. They like that poem, "If," it really preaches. That there's other poems like that. So before college, before I left high school, that godly wisdom was kicking in. The fear of the Lord, the beginning of wisdom, began to kick in my life. It was during high school I had a crisis of faith, came out of that crisis of faith near the end of high school, began to witness on campus. The fear of the Lord became pretty powerful, and I wrote a poem that got into the school's literary magazine. So I left something behind. A sobering message about true love. A sobering message that would be with for my high school. Love, it's entitled. I wrote it in 1968, age 18 then. Vainly spent has been my time, dreaming wishes into rhyme, hoping hopes of love. Beauty inspires quick desires, fascination's torchic fires, but this is not love. Neither bodies tall and strong, nor a bright face in the throng, constitute real love. Cestus belts to win love with, and Cupid's shafts are but myth, so do not cause love. Gazing eyes and lovely smile merely last a little while, give no sign of love. But in friendship, love unknown, until small bonds are outgrown, then begins real love. Sharing happiness and pain, in broke drought and fortune's rain, is the trait of love. Suffering the self to end, for a dual one to blend, this in truth is love. Thence arises beauty's light, shining into passion's night. Oh, what might has love? Poor man then, whose love is thrill of sight and touch, for he will never know true love. Love. Well, the poetic realm is a realm that can become a calling. And it doesn't mean a calling that's like a vocation type of calling that's going to make you money. But it's God putting his finger upon you and saying, you're the guy, you're the gal, you're going to do this for me. You know? And Creatives was a place where, you know, coming together and doing... Sometimes we used to have just one creative and some camps, and then you just do that creative, and the next thing you'll do art, the next thing you'll do drama or something like that. So the camps get bigger, and then you have a lot of selection. But this realm of creativity is something I really am glad for Glenn Clark, attaching on to this and making it part of the camp, because we are created in the image of the Creator, and he wants us to be created. He's put all these things. He's put poetry inside of our hearts. And it's like, that's where I started. I used to draw stick figures, little stick army men figures type of thing, and I never did any art, never had an art class in school. But so CFO was my first introduction to art, and it really gave me a thirst for it. So I've gone through maybe, 8 semesters of art since that time. Yeah. I love art. I love art, studying it, but when it comes down to being obedient to the Lord, it's not necessarily. A couple times I had to paint a picture, but it's really this. It's poetry. Coming down obedient to the Lord, it's coming forth. It's like a prophecy. It's coming forth, and it's got to be put down on paper. So creative is a great place for you to maybe find out that God is moving in you to make this a calling in your life. And so there are many realms of creativity that we can use, inspiration and skill that merge together and sometimes bring forth a message in music and art and drama. But what I'm going to do, instead of a list of creative things, I'm going to read a poem, and it's in another book. I'm going to read a poem called Creator, and this is a poem with a message. Someday you'll compose a song or sing one very well. Feel a thrill of satisfaction in a tale you tell. Draw a picture, paint a portrait, shape a lump of clay. Plan and build a dream house, act a part within a play. Plant a lovely flower garden, set a gem in gold. Cut and piece and sew an outfit new and sharp and bold. Tinker to invent a gadget, saving people time. Write an essay or a story, set in prose or rhyme. And while feeling fresh fulfillment where you have achieved, in the goal of each ambition by your mind conceived, you will pause when all about you birds are singing too. Wind is whistling, stars are shining. Everything you view whispers softly, hints behind them, of a happy mind, as if all that is around you stands both sealed and signed by a person, great designer, one you imitate, when you follow yearnings to be skillful and create. So, we are creators, imaging the Creator. And this is one of the aspects, poetry is one of those aspects that you can image God in. And I think it's important too. There are a lot of creative avenues, and they're all important. But there's especially influential is avenues that work with words. Why is that important? You know, words are very strange. A word can communicate all kinds of things that it's just, but it was just a word. Yeah, it was, but it can communicate all kinds of things. It's true. Good words affirm life. Bad words destroy life. That comes from Scripture, Proverbs 18:21. The tongue has the power of life and death, and those who love it will eat its fruit. We must be careful what words we use. And if God puts you into a creative realm and calls you into that realm, and it has to deal with words, we've got to be careful with our words because they are powerful. They are powerful. And because of God's use of words in this way, poetry has a prophetic dimension. It's used in prophecy, like in the book of Habakkuk, is full of poetry. But because of poetry's prophetic dimension, I believe that Satan seeks to raise up false poet prophets. You heard of false prophets. He's raising up false prophets. He also raises up false poet prophets. People who we read them and it sounds good, but then the message gets into our heart through the reading and the rhythm and the rhyme and whatever, and then we take on other values. So Satan's raising up these false poet prophets and God's trying to raise up godly ones. Takes the fear of the Lord to help them raise them up. Well, if you can take a short, well-planned and carefully written poem, and sometimes it can preach as much as a sermon. It can. So it's important for us to... I'm going to read two poems. The one poem that I was going to end with, I'm going to put it with this one. This poem is called Worthy Poets. Worthy Poets. And then I'm going to read a poem called False Poetry. We must be able to distinguish, and I think it's pretty easy if you have the fear of the Lord. Worthy poets. Those pretending to be poets, who are pranksters, pimps, and pests, are not poets, but are preachers preaching pride that pesters guests. But a poet is a potter throwing clay to carry jewels, or a painter painting portraits, setting beauty free from fools. Worthy poets serve as waiters for the God who gave them wit, laying feasts upon the table where the wisdom seekers sit. They proclaim as ancient prophets from their visions in the night, treasures lost within the darkness, guidance found within the light. Amid politics and prattle, claiming what is right or wrong, dare be still to sit and listen to the poets and their song. And if you can get a hold of a book like this, I have to say I took a book off the book table some time ago that I took home with me and started reading. It was a book that was similar to this. It's called Poems That Touch the Heart. If you ever get a copy of it, boy, man, hold on to it. It is full of these kinds of poems, worthy poems from worthy poets that trying to give a message. But there's another poem. And I was going to close with this, but I'm not going to close with it. It's called False Poetry. And it's a warning. It's for us to be warned, because poetry can be very inviting. It can be very beautiful. could be crafted very well by very good skill, but the inspiration does not come from the fear of the Lord. False poetry. When words enfold clandestine thought, and lips conceal a hidden heart, a rhythmic ruse is sometimes taught to ears attuned to verbal art. Arranged by practice, wit, and skill, a verse can reach into the mind and grab the reins for good or ill, to guide or garble, loose or bind. As painted lies play may trick the gaze, so poor but pleasant lines, when heard, may lay a trap of moral maze for minds to miss the higher word. With eloquence in days of old, when seers sang false prophecy, they captured simple souls with bold refrains enshrined in poetry. Let all beware these phrases tooled by wayward tongues with measures bright. Prevent your will from being fooled. Immerse yourselves in psalms of light. And you need to go through the psalms. There are psalms that just, the psalms touch every aspect of emotion in human hearts, if you go through the psalms. And they are filled with beautiful words that will, like that one I just read, just beautiful poetic words. But then don't neglect books like these. There are other psalms that psalmists have written that can nurture you. And if you give your mind to those and let those immerse your mind, it's going to prevent you from falling to the wayside by hearing bad poetry. And let me tell you, where is the poetry today? Do you hear, unless you go to some kind, sometimes there's a poetry reading night at a club or something, and there'll be people like that, but let me just, I've gone to some of those and I don't like them. I just do not like them because it's crap. I've never, in one of those readings, I've never come across a poem that was building up your inner man. And we need those kinds. Maybe we need those kinds of poems to be read in those meetings, you know. But a short, can be very short, but it's well-planned and carefully crafted poems can preach louder than a sermon. And they can actually preach longer than most sermons. The message in a poem sometimes can stick in your heart longer than a sermon sticks in your mind. And this poetic potential, I have to say, from my experience, I have to say that this poetic potential of what poetry can do has been neglected. I don't hear a lot of preachers who are practiced in poetry to know what to read to their congregation to supplement that sermon, to maybe make something for people to go away with. They need to know poetry. I've actually written an article about this on, have you ever heard of a website called Seedbed? Seedbed is a website that comes out of Tennessee. What's the school there? It's a seminary. Oh, I forget now. Asbury Seminary. It comes out of Asbury, and it's for pastors, and they invite articles. And so I wrote an article. I said, you know, we're neglecting poetry in the pulpit. And then I gave the same kind of things I'm sharing with you. God uses poetry right in there, in the Bible. And God put it from the very beginning all the way to the book of Revelation. Open up the book of Revelation. What are people doing? They're singing songs. Read them. They're written in verse and rhyme. Some of them in rhyme, in Greek. But they're written in verse. They have meter. They're something that will stick in the mind. Poems are sometimes like that. They can stick in the mind and help people to whatever the message the pastor did preach, that's sort of like the nailing it down and making it stick in their minds. But poetry today, if I told, well, what are you called to do? What's your calling? You know, you're not going to hear married people say, oh, it's poetry. Yeah, poetry? Poetry? Well, it's not perceived as a calling. First of all, our schools, our public school system, it's passé. poetry is sort of passé. It's outmoded. It's okay. The only place you hear them poems are put to music, and you hear them on popular songs and stuff. That's about all you hear of poetry is in music, and that's okay. But there needs to be more. It was amazing when I was watching the movie Spartacus, okay, with Kirk Douglas and Tony Curtis. Tony Curtis was a poet, and they were both slaves, and they were set free. And Spartacus, you know, says to this poet, Tony Curtis, said, "Sing us a song, sing us a song." "Oh, I haven't sung any songs for a long time, you know." And he said, "Sing us one. You're a poet." Okay, so he gets up, and what does he do? He quotes poetry. He has no melody with it. He just quotes poetry. That was their idea of singing. That was also singing. It's just to quote poetry. So I've been singing some solos tonight and some of these things. Well, I believe God is still looking at, I've written some poems, okay, and everybody has it in them. But is God calling you? You know, we shouldn't be saying, "Well, is poetry still in vogue?" That shouldn't be the question that we should have. But is the God, the original poet behind the Bible, is he still using poetry today? That's the question. And is he calling me to be one of his poets? You know? And think about that. That's what we should be looking at. Not if it's popular or that thing, but is God still using it? And I believe God is still looking for willing hearts. I think he's looking for people who will be channels for his voice. You know, young Samuel, he was just a child. I was just a little kid when I started writing poetry, but I really believe that, you know, we have to have that kind of heart that that young Samuel had, where he said, "Speak, Lord, for your servant is listening." And when he did speak, he began to give a prophecy of what he was listening to from God. And I believe God is still looking for willing hearts who will be channels of his prophetic, poetic voice. His prophetic, poetic voice, as young Samuel was. Well, Creatives has been a place where a lot of my poems have come to me. And I was in Creatives, I think it was in Alliance CFO when we used to meet down in, what's that place? It's outside of Sebastopol. Yeah, that's where we used to. A big, gigantic camp. It's where is Alliance Camp. It was used to be named after that Alliance Camp. That's the original Alliance. Well, and actually this camp was born from that Alliance Camp, Silver Sierra. Now Alliance is gone. But I was at that camp, and it was a large camp, and I don't usually write in free verse. Once in a while I do when the poem comes that way to me, but I usually work on the poetry part. But this poem came to me, and it was just almost like God's heart was overflowing, and I was receiving the overflow, and it became something I had to write. It's called The Dance. And let's see if I can find it here. The Dance, here it is. And this is what you call free verse, okay? Three great pairs of loving hands firmly grasped in joyous dance, spreading brilliant, sparkling orbs around a universe of void, filling worlds with nature's gems, moving newly fashioned minds with awe until they bow in praise. Years go by. The brilliance lasts, yet creatures, imaged from the three, forget the awe, count commonplace this dazzling, artful universe, and dwell upon their meager meals of wisdom's pride and boast. Break out, free dancers, dear God, dance, hit the pew on pulpits dance, turn classrooms to a whirling reel, melt hardened hearts with prancing fire, to spread the flame throughout the world and shine to all this tale to tell. The free still live. The free still dance. Come, join them for eternity. Our God is that trinity of dancers. And I could just see the trinity holding hands in a big reel of dancing when that poem came to me. And so it overflowed from my heart. Now, of course, I'm prejudiced. I'm prejudiced on this poetry thing. I'm prejudiced. I think that the public schools and the Christian schools should never have stopped making kids memorize classic poetry. It used to be a standard. You went to school, and if you came home from school, you knew that your parents were going to, what did you memorize? And I just recently, on LibriVox.org, which is an audio book that you can get for free, one of the poem books, poems that every child should know, written in 1904 by a school teacher. And she collected these poems from her classmates. Teacher, put this one in. Teacher, put this one in. They're from books like this. They're really classical poems, and these kids are memorizing them at public school system. Well, I wish that had never gone away. Poems used to be in daily newspapers. You could open up a newspaper and know there's going to be a poem section. You could go there and maybe read two or three. How many have read a poem in a newspaper recently? Recently? I haven't seen a poem in a newspaper for years. And I believe they should have never disappeared from magazines that are both Christian and secular. Because I haven't seen poetry in Christian magazines lately either. And it's really sad. Today's pews, as I said, should be hearing poetry. Good classical, good message poetry. Not roses red, violets are blue kind of stuff, you know. But real good poetry with a message are just like our grandparents did. They heard. That's when they had a sermon, they went home, they'd already heard a poem that day because they heard a sermon. And the preachers were poetry literate. Well, these deficiencies in our society, these deficiencies are basically causing our children to grow up poetry illiterate. And they don't understand that like the kids in the past. So if God used poetry so effectively in the past, and it's being neglected now, I think we know who the culprit behind that is, don't we? It's Satan. Satan always tries to use God's strategies and undermine them. He sometimes takes them and uses them himself, or he just undermines them and tries to get rid of them. But the devil is powerless against the perfect poem. The devil is powerless against the perfect poem. And I wrote that perfect poem in which book? Oh, here it is. No, that may be audacious to say I wrote the perfect poem, but let me let you hear it. Let you hear what this poetry is. What is the perfect poem? When a poet is a prophet, when the singing strikes and stings at the shifting social conscience modern foolish thinking brings, we're reminded of the poem from God's lips of love sublime, Jesus Christ, the Word incarnate. Perfect rhythm, perfect rhyme. God spoke nature into being, beasts and rivers, rocks and hills, trees and sunsets, stars and seasons, human passions, human wills. Then, because we fail to listen, God, in perfect harmony with himself, the song and music, sang to us his melody. Passions twisted and perverted by our wills that went astray, wander blindly through a wasteland that we know so well today. But God's law still speaks within us by true guilt when we are wrong, and true grace will only greet us at the singing of his song. There is hope for our confusion, dissonance from sins we sung. Hear the rhapsody of passion on the cross where Jesus hung. Perfect words for perfect healing. Peace throughout eternity. in the chorus choir of heaven if we choose God's poetry. He can never defeat the Lord Jesus. So, ultimately, the reason that I write poetry is Jesus. It's Jesus, the Lamb of God, the Lion of the tribe of Judah. And I like that image of the lion. I love the Aslan, the stories in Narnia. I love the image of the lion. Because one of the verses that blessed me as a preacher is Amos chapter 3, verse 8, where he says this: "The lion has roared, who will not fear? The sovereign Lord has spoken, who can but prophesy?" And I would add to that, the sovereign Lord has spoken, who can but write poetry? It's that overflowing of the heart that that brings out something with a theme that gets a hold of you. I wasn't going to read this poem, but we have time, and I would like to read this poem in closing. And then I would like to actually read another poem that I've written. We are going to have communion this week, right? Yeah, okay. And this is just to get your mind thinking in terms of communion. But I want to read this poem that closes this book, and it's really a nice poem to close a book with, as far as poetry. And it's from Rudyard Kipling again. And it's a French word, l'envoi. L'envoi. L'envoi in French means the send-off. The send-off, you know? Listen to this. "When Earth's last picture is painted, and the tubes are twisted and dried, when the oldest colors have faded, and the youngest critic has died, we shall rest, and fate we shall need it, lie down for an eon or two, till the master of all good workmen shall set us to work anew. And those that were good will be happy, they shall sit in a golden chair, they shall splash at a 10-league canvas with brushes of comet's hair, they shall find real saints to draw from, Magdalene, Peter, and Paul. They shall work for an age at a sitting and never be tired at all. And only the Master shall praise us, and only the Master shall blame. And no one shall work for money, and no one shall work for fame. But each for the joy of the working, and each in his separate star shall draw the thing as he sees it, for the God of the things as they are." I love that. I love that l'envoi, because, you know, someday our creativity is going to be over down here. Our creativity is going to be done. Our work will be over with. Whatever God has put your hand to, someday it's going to be done. And that's going to be the last until we get to heaven. And let me tell you, I've thought about that. Yeah, I'd like to learn how to paint better. I'd like to sit down at a 10-league canvas and work for an age at a 10-league canvas with paint that never will fade. But think about writing with unlimited vocabulary, because you have every tongue, tribe and tongue will be there. I mean, all the languages will be known. We shall know as we are known. We're going to know all the languages probably too. And just think of all the rhymes we could make, and all the flow. And if you have more tools, you can work more. So yeah, poetry is still going to be something we do in heaven, I believe. And I think painting too. And a whole bunch of other creative things. We know architecture, you know, is one of those things. I want to read a poem that, this is a poem that I've just written not too long ago. It's called Eden's Table. And one of the things about poetry, and if you get this in your life, like you're writing something, and you don't want to just state it as it is, but you state it because it's a metaphor, like the song, like the Ecclesiastes, writer of Ecclesiastes wrote those metaphors about aging. There's something God uses in a metaphor. It's like something that's sort of built into us. In fact, words themselves are just symbols. They're just symbols of something else that's real. And so there's something built into us that makes metaphors and the use of metaphors something that we're attracted to. So this idea, if you are thinking in those terms and you're studying Scripture, you begin to see a whole bunch of things that are little parallels that are from Garden of Eden to heaven. Like, for instance, marriage. Marriage in the beginning in the garden, and marriage in the middle in Song of Solomon, and marriage at the Lamb. It's like a theme that God has through. Well, the table, the communion table, is very precious to me, and I've had a lot of different thoughts about it. But this is one thought that came to me, and we're going to be having communion this week. And so maybe this can help prepare your hearts a little bit. I lived with nature, and nature cherished me. The Maker meant for us to dance throughout eternity. But I loved a wisdom nature didn't know. She only knew who gave her life and caused her form to grow. I too sought beauty, though beauty was my home. In hot pursuit of pretty things, I left her side to roam. But in my searching, I lost my deeper sight. As on I chased elusive dreams, I stumbled in the night. And I liked eating, so nature held a feast to strengthen me to serve and rule the fish, the fowl, and beast. But I craved knowledge to please my hungry will with moral freedom's deadly fruit, which plagues creation still. Yet God loved humans who strayed from Eden's path to wander body, soul, and mind beneath redemptive wrath. He set a table with His own beauty's love, inviting our return to feed on wisdom from above. Life's tree has furnished this food of mystery, renourishing the wayward self back to its destiny. Christ is the nurture, restoring Eden's bliss, His flesh and blood, the holy meal that sinners mustn't miss.